Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm your host, David Santo, and today on the show, we're going to spend some time thinking about food labor, epistemology, plumbing, and taste. Most of all, we're diving deep into the idea of relationality and how the multiple, overlapping ways in which we interact with food makes it the most complex and delightful relationship that any of us participates in. But first, have a listen to this. That was the sound of complex relationships, or at least my rather specific interpretation of them. It's actually an angklung that we just heard, an Indonesian percussion instrument. Angklungs range in size, but this one is about 6 feet tall and 8 feet long, with dozens of precisely tuned bamboo tubes hanging from an upright wooden frame, a bit like a giant xylophone or a set of handbells. It belongs to Jess Tsang, a percussionist, researcher, and improviser based in Brooklyn, New York. Jess brought the angklung to Montreal for a food and music performance project we were both working on, and it was just a beautiful instrument to behold and to play. It was actually quite simple to play, but made up of all of these different pieces, as well as thousands of stories and kilometers and relationships and interactions and sounds, of course. It's both simple and complex. Sometimes easy to engage with, sometimes a bit more challenging. In food terms, it's a bit like a banana. What? Yeah, a banana. A yellow fruit that grows in bunches on a tree. A quick snack, a source of potassium and protein and fiber and sugar, but also an icon of jokes, both sexual and slapstick. An ingredient in ice cream dishes, and therefore an ingredient in the history of ice cream parlors and family celebrations and a bunch of other stuff. It's also a food that's grown in environmentally damaging monocultural plantations in the global south, ones that wreak havoc on people and on the planet. And it's a plant species that's been subject to botanical experimentation and many, many viruses and all the diseases that come with viruses, as well as a part of the food industry that supports exploitative economies and carbon emissions and political power plays. It's a banana, a set of complex and simple relationships with a lot more going on than meets the eye. So that's kind of what I want to get at with this podcast. I want us to get closer to what seems obvious in food and food culture and food systems, and then to start seeing and honoring the many relationships behind and within them. Because the thing is, we never just relate to food as plain food. It's many, many things to us. It's, yes, it's our day-to-day nourishment, of course. But by growing and cooking and eating food, we also construct our individual and cultural identities, our social values, our culinary systems. And then at the global scale, food's even more complex. It's a political and economic weapon. It's also a tool of diplomacy and peacemaking. And it's a significant contributor to climate change and environmental degradation. All these relationships make food pretty intense. And sometimes, as eaters, we just want things to be easy and convenient. That is incredibly normal. But ease comes with its own challenges. And when we opt for simple convenience and think about our own needs first, it can have really problematic effects for others, including large populations and places that we just never encounter face to face. To start us off on this exploration of food relationships, I'm talking today with a philosopher of food and a food business entrepreneur. I'll also be feeding my partner Maxime something really awful during the Stick This in Your Mouth segment. And closing the episode, you'll hear from our first respondent to the Making a Meal of It food questionnaire. Plus, if you listen to the end, I'll explain how all of these people are connected through a web of pretty cool food relationships. First up, Dr. Lisa Helke, a pragmatist feminist philosopher of food who teaches at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. Lisa has helped a couple of generations of food researchers understand what she calls the plumbing that sits behind the ways we know, interact with, and make food culture. She's also an author and co-editor of several books on food, including Philosophers at Table on Food and Being Human, and Exotic Appetites, Ruminations of a Food Adventurer. So Lisa, thank you so much for joining me, joining us on this episode of Making a Meal of It. I'm really delighted to have you here and to be talking to you about food and philosophy. And I'd like to start it off with that and just ask you how this became one of your major areas of work.
Well, it's really great to be with you, David, and I'm excited about your new podcast. That's an interesting question. In some ways, I think I was a food philosopher, you know, as a little kid, although, of course, I didn't know what philosophy was, let alone what food philosophy was. The first thing that I did that could be called philosophy of food was to throw in an example at the end of my dissertation. So I wrote a dissertation on epistemology, the theory of knowledge is what we normally would say when we were not being snobby. In the end of it, I sort of used this little analogy where I said, what I've offered you here is kind of like a recipe book. And recipes are the sorts of things where, you know, some recipes are very exacting and others are very forgiving and you can sort of do whatever you want. And I just sort of threw that in. And my then partner, who was also a philosopher, said, you know, that's kind of an interesting idea. Maybe you should develop that a little bit. And so I wrote a paper called Recipes for Theory Making, which was, I guess it wasn't my very first publication, but it was my second. And let me just say, not best foot forward, really. And if you, say, went on a job interview, as I did repeatedly with a talk about the philosophy of food, the best that would come out of it would people would say something like, oh, so brave, which it turns out does not mean we want you to be our colleague. It means you are a nut job.
You are brave for stepping into a space that doesn't exist.
Yes, yes, yes. And whenever I would say to anybody, I'm working on epistemology, on the theory of knowledge, they would say, oh, what scientific question are you thinking about? Because there's a way in which in the academy today, knowledge equals science. And, you know, maybe we're moving away from that a little bit since 1986. I don't know. And then along comes someone saying, well, maybe you could think about food and food making as an inquiry activity. And I was like, yeah, maybe I could. And what was so exciting for me about that, honestly, was that I felt like I had come in from the cold. I grew up in, you know, rural northern Wisconsin in a family that was deeply involved in 4-H. I mean, I studied cooking, as it were, in 4-H as a little tiny kid. And all through graduate school, I felt like I needed to hide all of those parts of myself because they weren't academic, they weren't serious, they weren't forms of knowledge. So it was, for me, really exciting to start giving myself permission to tap into my own life, to tap into my own history, and think about how, yeah, cooking recipes were actually forms of knowledge creation that, you know, hint, hint, women tended to be the purveyors of. And so that was another thing, was that while I had always thought of myself as, you know, kind of girl power, I also kind of came into myself as a feminist in graduate school. And so it really felt like, yeah, this is an act of feminist resistance to talk about food and cooking. Maybe one that not all feminists were thrilled about, right? Because that was a period of time in which feminists were sort of like, we need to not do that girly stuff because we won't get taken seriously. So there was a certain amount of risk even from the feminist community.
So you knew you were a food philosopher from a young age. What do people say to you when they hear, oh, hi, I'm Lisa, I'm a food philosopher? Mm-hmm.
In ordinary life, if you say you're a philosopher of food, you know, really throughout, people have responded with, well, that seems interesting. And like, do you get a lot of free meals? In other words, for folks who are not inside the discipline of philosophy and maybe even not inside academia, it feels like, well, obviously philosophy should study food because we notice that it's important. Inside of academia now I get enthusiasm and interest, I would say, for the most part. Historically, I mean, it took a long time. The first book that I published was an anthology with my then colleague, Dean Curtin. It's called Cooking, Eating, Thinking. And that book, I heard from more than one friend at other institutions that someone had, you know, posted it on their office door, you know, with a yuck, yuck, can you believe what the profession has descended to, you know, like even cook, you know, like sort of what's next, dust. It's a real sign of the evolution. So that's really, you know, really exciting.
Well, yeah. And for better or mostly often for worse, the crises that are happening in food systems around the world and things like war and consumer price indices and inflation and environmental degradation, everything that is happening to food these days means that food is at least on the radar of a lot more people. And so when we say, oh, you're a food philosopher, good, because we need some people helping us figure out some of those basic right. elements, those basic understanding, what you call sometimes the plumbing of human existence. So I'd love it if you would expand a bit on that, this idea that philosophy serves as a kind of plumbing for the way we go about our daily operations.
Yeah. So philosophy as plumbing. There is a now deceased, wonderful British philosopher named Mary Midgley. And boy, of the people that you wish you had known about much earlier in life, she looms large for me. She, you know, came up at the time of World War II and was basically in this cohort of four women. And each of them, in one way or another, went on to do really spectacular things as a philosopher. And Mary Midgley, I guess, was sort of the last to flourish. And she wrote something like, I don't know, 20 books after she was 50 years old. Wow. I mean, just, she had this amazing output. She also lived to be in her mid 90s and I think must have died with a pen in her hand because, you know, her last book was published, I think, posthumously. Anyway, she's done a variety of work on a variety of things. And one of the things that I love about her is that she's very plain spoken and she uses analogies really effectively. And so years ago, my writing colleague and my friend Ray Boisvert introduced me to this phrase that Mary Midgley uses, and I use it all the time now. And she says that philosophy is like plumbing; it sort of runs along behind the walls of our, you know, of our houses, our lives, and it provides these absolutely essential services. And we pretty much ignore it until it breaks down. And then we do everything in our power to fix it in the least dramatic way. I came home after a summer of being away and looked up at my dining room ceiling and saw water spots. And I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to tear out the ceiling and, you know, all these things. And then a guy came over and he said, actually, I think you just got a little clog in your shower drain. And if we clean it out, and you know, the sense of relief when you think, oh, I don't have to tear apart my house to fix this absolutely fundamental system. So philosophical systems, the last thing you want to do is say, well, you know, I think I'm going to rethink the subject-object dichotomy because I failed to pick up my bagel this morning, right? Like we do the least invasive thing we can. You know, you clean the hair out of the drain, you put on a new faucet, you replace the washer. But sometimes really fundamental things need to happen. And I'm really interested in thinking about those. So that's why that analogy for me is so powerful. I'm in a school of philosophy that's known as American pragmatism, and we sort of say, let's start with where we are and figure out what are the things that need to be shifted in order for us to, you know, do better in the world, to live better in the world. And so that plumbing analogy really works for me.
You said that a lot of your work and as an American pragmatist philosopher, you start with where you are. And a lot of your writing does start very much with a specific food act. You talk about kneading bread dough. You talk about gardening and farming. You talk about hands in soil, making a pie. And for example, when I'm using your books in my classes or your chapters and articles in my classes, my students really respond to that kind of philosophy because they know it starts from something that they know too, rather than starting from an abstract idea. But so tell me a bit about that kickoff point that you often use in your writing to explain something that maybe is a little complex or complicated, but that becomes more evident, more visible because it is linked to a specific food act.
Mm-hmm. I think that that tendency probably comes from two things. One is certainly that I'm a teacher of undergraduates. So I teach at a small liberal arts college where all of my students are, you know, 18 to 22 almost exclusively. And so maybe have somewhat fewer experiences in the world than if I were teaching, you know, older students or more advanced students. Many of them are taking their first and probably only philosophy class with me. And the other thing is that I really do think that, you know, we talk about philosophy as therapy or something like that. And I'm not saying I am a philosophical therapist, but I would say that my philosophy really almost always comes from something in which I realize I've got to figure this out for myself. It's really painful, or it's really interesting, or it's really challenging. Something happens to me. And so, yes, I, you know, can be walking my dog in the woods, listening to a public radio broadcast about, you know, fungus and see mushrooms on the ground and suddenly start thinking about things as a result of that very concrete experience. You know, I mean, I've been at my institution 35 years. People here actually think philosophy of food is just a thing. Like, they don't know that it didn't used to be, right? You know, there's a way in which I am what philosophy looks like to them. And so I get to just do it and be ordinary at it. And
well, I know I'm biased, but I would hardly say that you are ordinary at it because you are doing it in what I think is the most important subject that there is. I mean, think food and philosophy, as you said, didn't necessarily historically to go together, but there's been an awful lot of thinking and theorizing about food in abstract ways throughout the history of the writing on food, which is actually itself quite a short history relative to the other histories of architecture and dance and theater and math and science and all the other things. And so yeah, it's not ordinary, it's critical. It's so much a part of we are as humans, and having a better understanding about the kinds of understanding that you provide about what it means to be with our food or to be with our species, whether it's a mushroom or a dog or other creatures that we are codependent with, coming to understand those as not objects that we stick in our mouth only, but, and we do stick them in our mouths, but we also need to respect them and caretake them while they are alive and not yet in our mouths. Those are critical relationships that philosophy seems to be able to unpack and explain better than a lot of other forms of knowledge making or forms of inquiry. Mm-hmm. So ordinary, important.
Well, this is an aside, but as you were talking about, you know, there is more philosophy in the history of food. That's absolutely right. And I think I feel like I need to swat myself a little bit and say, there's also more food in the history of philosophy than meets the eye when you're like looking for page upon page of long discussion about food. Years and years ago, I wrote a little piece about the ways in which I sort of jokingly said Plato was the first philosopher of food. And when you go and look in the index of his, you know, the big, big book of Plato, you find tons of discussions of food and its importance. And, you know, for instance, his Republic, which is maybe his most famous dialogue, explains justice by talking about why a community goes to war. And it's because they need more land. And why do they need more land? Because people have started to want to eat meat. And it all unravels from there, right? So I think if we shift our frame slightly, we will realize that those philosophers, historically, those philosophers have thought food was important. And maybe it's more of a blip, a post-Cartesian blip, that we weren't taking food seriously. And why did it happen then? Well, because Descartes suggested to us, maybe we don't need our bodies. You know? So then it was easier to sort of say, okay.
So maybe food philosophy today is about reintegrating all the stuff that we've already known for thousands of years, and maybe that food is the most important relationship that humans have, and we better understand it a bit better than we currently do.
Yes, that might be a great way to think about it. Hey, you food philosophy historians of food philosophy out there, consider this your invitation. The terrain is wide open.
Yeah, and I know a really great small liberal arts college where you could go and do your first degree.
There you go.
I talk about food as being a complex ecology. I think food is very complex. It doesn't have to be complicated, but it gets oversimplified. What do you think about those terms, complex, complexity, complicatedness, and simple or easy when it comes to food?
I'm teaching a class right now where we're thinking about food as a series of wicked problems. And in the course of that, we are reading a work by Nicola Perullo, who's an Italian scholar who works at the University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy, which is an incredibly fun place. And Nicola has this book called taste as experience. And he talks about tasting as ecological. And he uses that rather than cultural because he really wants to emphasize the fact that food is constantly, you know, with no effort whatsoever, it is bridging the nature-culture gap. So I think using that word ecology is really wonderful. And it feels to me like, yes, complex, probably also often complicated. What I say sometimes to describe it is, when I was working on my first work on food, I was still connected with the Northwestern University Library. And Northwestern's library in Evanston, Illinois, is in three separate towers, each of which I think is four levels tall. I had to go to every single floor of every single tower. And that to me said, this is the way food works. It's everywhere. What's that movie? Everywhere All at Once. Everything, Everything, Everywhere All at Once. It quite literally is. It's such a spectacularly integrative way to inquire into the world. As you say, we often tend to boil it down to one thing or another, but if we allow ourselves, it's very multi-leveled, which means, yes, you're always outside of your comfort zone. You're always trying to think about a question you have no business answering, which is why ideally you are always in a room with political scientists and anthropologists and food chemists and agricultural economists and a couple philosophers.
Just a handful. Well, and if we can have conversations like this every day that bring together all of those people and think through how food and philosophy and war and economics and all the politics and all the other things are interconnected, maybe we might start to move towards maybe not solutions to wicked problems, but ways to engage with them in ways that are more productive, less destructive, fairer, more delicious.
That would be good. And
cross
deliciousness needs to be in there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, on that note, on that delicious note, thank you so much again for talking with me. It's been a real pleasure. And I hope that you continue to have delicious walks in the forest with your dog and all sorts of delicious things in your life.
Well, thank you, David. And I wish the same for you. Well, you don't have to have a dog.
Thank you. And check out our show notes for more about Lisa, the Nobel conference she organizes each year, and her undying love for bread baking, living in a yurt, and ski-joring with her husky. My next guest is Taylor Cocalis-Suarez. Taylor and I met in Colorno, Italy, just north of Parma, in 2005. We had both taken the leap to do a master's degree at the University of Gastronomic Sciences, and Taylor has been taking leaps ever since. Today, she co-manages the Suarez Family Brewery with her life partner, Dan Suarez, as well as Good Food Jobs, a gastro job search tool she founded with Dorothy Neagle. Taylor has always been my touchstone for the ways in which food is just the greatest foundation of human relationships. And today she'll also explain how working in food sometimes presents challenges to the so-called normal ways of doing business. Well, Taylor, thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you again about our favorite subject, food. I tend to think of you as like the biggest food professional I know because you have fingers in so many different pies. But tell me a little bit about what food means to you, just in the big picture.
Oh my goodness. You're really starting it off light, right?
Sure.
Okay. So the thing that I keep coming back to is food is a mode of connection. So how it first manifested when I was a teenager is that I really got into making food. And for me, it was a way to be connected to a process. It felt very grounding in a world that didn't always make sense. The idea that you could take disparate ingredients and put them together was really cool because it gave you some agency. And it was a way to like develop a skill and a craft. But then perhaps the even more empowering part of it is that I took these things that I created and then I shared them with other people. And so this is a very simple thing. You've got a girl from New Jersey who's baking cookies and bringing them to school in a basket and handing them out to your classmates helped me both forge relationships, and there was an element of care to it. But there was also like a way of establishing an identity, you know, you become known as the person that is able to craft these things.
Well, and that's exactly, I mean, when you and I first met 18 years ago in Italy doing our master's degrees, that was exactly it. It was about these, this caretaking and this relationship and this identity, set of relationships and this identity that you very quickly established for yourself as the provider of, let's say it, love. And your baskets of goodies that you would come into our classroom every day with really, I mean, they drew a lot of attention to you. They gave you power and identity and a sense of place within this group of very disparate people. And you had some of the most wonderful relationships in my memory with all of our classmates.
That's been very kind of you to say. Since then, it's taken on even different points of connection. So not just to people and establishing human relationships, but endeavors in gardening and understanding our connection to land and establishing our connection to, you know, nature and the elements and understanding how this is all a dance. We are all in relationship with each other.
And acknowledging that is really sort of at the root of understanding why food and food systems are both complex and also very, very simple, because it's just about the relationships and being attentive to those relationships. Do you think of, you know, I talk about in the show that the food is complex, but do you think of food as complex?
I think about that a lot in terms of food because I work very practically in these two realms right now. So I've got Good Food Jobs, which is this community of people who are looking to do meaningful food work, which I kind of put in the bucket of theory. And then I also started a very small production-based brewery with my significant other, where he and the people with whom we work, it's a small team of just 6.5 of us right now. But that is more the practice side of it. And with the brewery, it's all about creating the simplest beer we possibly can and not necessarily doing things that are new or novel. It's being in relationship with the yeast and kind of doing the dance and understanding what they need to be able to thrive. It's just interesting because I think about the consolidation of our food systems, and we're fed these messages of individualism and sort of this idea of control, like nature is here and we're trying to bend nature to our will or exert our control over other creatures or other human beings. And I think food is just a great example of that because a lot of the industrial food systems are made to disconnect us from the seasons or disconnect us from the mode of production or disconnect us from the way in which we enjoy and appreciate food, like diet culture, for example.
Sort of a polishing away of the interesting elements that make food complex in the industrial food system.
Yeah. And we look to the root of this, like having gone through the experience of opening the brewery, like I understand why there has been a structural simplification of the processes, because we need to remain flexible to be able to do the things we need to do. It's like, okay, Dan or Matt have to go in sometimes on a Sunday to do a diacetyl test. And if the beer is not ready yet, then they need to delay dropping the temperature, and then that might affect the production schedule. And so it becomes harder to schedule workers in. And like, I get the flip side of that. It's like, we're trying to keep everyone on our, that works at the brewery, like on a 4-day work week and always get the same days off so that there's a degree of like consistency for their lives. It's like, that's a workers' rights thing that I want for people. And so how do you manage these two things together. And like the only way we can manage it is by being deliberately slow and deliberately small so that we're not taking on more than we can chew, because it takes a lot of work to manage all of that. It's also important to note that food systems in general, like especially in the United States, are inextricably linked to about 400 years of slavery in this country. Yeah. So understanding the devaluing of labor, of people that are producing food, whether that is agricultural workers in the field, or people at processing plants, or people who are working in restaurants, be it the back of house or the front of house. There are so many layers there.
So just, I wanted to just turn a corner for a moment, because you were, I love the way you described that the brewery as the practice and good food jobs, the online community and job search website, let's call it. It is a website, but it is also much more than that. And then you describe good food jobs more as the theory. But as you were describing the brewery, you're also getting into a lot of theory. And so I suspect that, you know, both of your endeavors are both very blended in theory and practice. And I think that's one of the things that makes them so worthy and so successful in so many ways, in the value that they're creating for the world of food.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So I met you in Italy. We were both doing a year-long master's program at the university that Slow Food founded. So we were getting a master's in food culture. I came back to New York City and got a job doing one of the only things that I was uniquely qualified to do based on my undergraduate and graduate degree. So I studied hospitality management in undergrad. I studied food culture for my master's. And so I was running the education program at a cheese shop in New York City. So we were putting on classes where we were educating people about different types of traditional food, namely like cheese, wine, beer, cured meat, olive oil. And so when I was there, I was getting so many people who were coming to me saying, I also have an interest in food and I also feel really connected to it. And I want to find a way to channel that interest into my life's work in the way that you have, but I just don't know how to do that. So essentially, Good Food Jobs was created as a resource to be able to connect people who had an interest in work with the opportunities that were available. So it's a very simple concept and business model. But what Dorothy, who's my business partner, and I have learned over all these years, again, is that it's about so much more than just the food. It really is about the community. So there are very simple mechanisms to how the website works. It's like people who have these jobs post them, and people who are looking for these jobs theoretically find them, but it sparks all of this meaningful connection. And it was just interesting. You know, we are not like your typical web startup. It's not that we got millions of dollars of seed funding and have a huge staff. We're not like plugged into like all the data and analyzing data. But we can see, we can get a feeling for the tide and a sense of what's going on just through the natural ebbs and flows of the jobs we would see coming through and the volume of jobs, or how many new subscribers there are or not, or just the stories that people are telling us. And it felt like, oh gosh, like what can we do? And then the pandemic happened, and you know, a huge supposed racial reckoning happened. But through that, kind of established a foundation where we could continue to be able to look at all the ways in which the systems that we had created were complicit in the way that the status quo operated. And so we started going through all of the processes of Good Food Jobs, trying to enact slow and deliberate cultural change. So a really good example of this practically is that jobs come in and our editorial policy says we have 24 hours to look through the job and approve them or ask any questions that we might have. And that was like usually a pretty quick process, but we really started looking at the language and job descriptions and understanding how language is used in ways that can be intentionally or unintentionally oppressive.
Well, language is one of the fundamental ways that systemic oppression enacts itself. And it's so baked in.
Yes.
And it's so, you know, language is so critical and necessary for almost everything that we do as humans. And yet it's also, depending on where we come from and how we've been educated and how we deploy that language, it's also one of the greatest tools for dividing people.
For sure. It takes a little bit more work. I mean, it has taken us more work. It takes more time to approve the jobs. And often there's just more steps in the process because there are certain things that we'll read. And then we say, okay, pause. Instead of collecting the revenue for this job, we want to reach out and engage this employer. Did you know that this specific job requirement is rooted in oppression in X, Y, or Z way?
So, I mean, this is why I would say that Good Food Jobs is very, very, very much grounded in practice. I mean, you're taking the theory of systemic racism or systemic oppression that's based in the language usage that's been codified over X number of years, including in many of the same ways that food has been codified over the last 400 years. So has language in many ways that embed either, as you said, visible or not so visible forms of oppression. That's enacting major practical change at the very ground level of labor, of work. Oh. What I hear you doing and what you've just described is looking out for as many people and as many beings, including yeast and small woodland creatures, just taking care of them as much as possible as you continue to have a business, make money, affect people's lives, produce products, have children, do all the stuff that is kind of regular stuff in human life, but with such attention that you're not, or you're contributing as little oppression and as little negativity as possible to the mix, despite the fact that you're also embedded in that system of oppression, because we all are.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I think the thing that is really important to know is that in any of the practice we do, I don't do it perfectly. I don't. No. There is so much to learn. Yeah. People are special.
People are. You are special. Thank you so much for being part of this conversation. Thank you for being this conversation. Thank you for all of the relationships you've had with me over the many years and will continue to have, and all the relationships you've introduced me to and helped me understand. I really appreciate it.
Thank you to you, David. Words can't describe what it means to be in relationship with you.
Thank you. For more about the Suarez Family Brewery and Good Food Jobs, check out their websites at suarezfamilybrewery.com and goodfoodjobs.com, and on Instagram under the same handles. So this is the part of the show called Stick This in Your Mouth, where I sit across my dining room table from my partner, Maxime. Bonjour, Maxime, ça va?
Bonjour.
Thank you for being here. And we talk about taste, how different things taste, but not just how they taste in our mouths, how they taste in our minds, too. Because, of course, taste is a combination of factors. There's the physiological sensing that happens when you put something in our mouth and when we smell it. But there's also a lot of elements of taste that are related to our history, our education, how we grew up, what we've tasted before. And then also it's related to our future, what our expectations are of a certain food. If we expect it to taste very sour and it's actually very sweet, that's surprising. It may not be pleasant, vice versa. But if something corresponds to our expectations, we often think, oh, that tastes good. And so a lot of how we taste is really about where we've come from and where we're going. And it all crystallizes in this moment when we put something in our mouth. So that's what we're going to try to figure out and talk about and explore. Because, Maxime, your taste is very similar to mine in food and in art and in culture and a lot of things. And that's also very different. How would you say that we're different or similar?
You're more open to many flavors and textures than I am. I was a very picky eater as a child. I was turned off by anything that had any kind of rubbery texture or squishy textures like a tomato, badly cooked shrimp. I hated mushroom. I couldn't stand them. Bananas.
And a lot of that's changed, actually, because now you eat many of those
things. I try to educate myself in not being as picky as I was, but I still am. Not a big fan of cheese. Foods like pieuvre.
Octopus.
Yes.
And that's another one of those sort of rubbery texture things.
Yeah.
But you grew up in southeastern Quebec in the Beauce region.
So I come from Saint-Georges-de-Beauce, the region where we have the best maple syrup. I was very attracted to sweetness as a kid, as most kids are. My dad was actually a fisherman and a hunter, even though you would think as a picky eater, I would also, that would include those types of meat or those fishes. I actually love these two categories. So because they were entered very young into my vocabulary of food.
So one of the reasons I'm really excited to have you doing this segment with me is because I know a lot about food and I've got very wide experiences. And as you said, I'm very open to stuff, but you, I think, sense things much more strongly than I do. Your palate, your capacity to smell things is way stronger than mine. You smell things and taste things in the food that I make that I didn't even know I'd put in or didn't recognize when I taste them. Sensing is very much part of your life, as it is mine, but from mine's much more a sort of theoretical form of sensing because I just don't think I have a very sensitive olfactory and palate system. Mm-hmm. But you do.
It's a blessing and a curse.
What's a blessing and a curse? Because you do feel things very strongly sometimes.
Yes.
Okay, Maxime, there is a banana on the table in front of us right now. How are you feeling?
I am very, very scared. Where to start? Family lore says that I was a banana eater when I was very young and I ate too much and I got really sick. And ever since, everything about the banana turns me off. The smell of it, the look of it, the texture, and everything about it.
Okay, so you actually threw up because you ate so many bananas.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
There's lots of kids like bananas. Yeah. We often feed kids bananas because it's got a lot of sugar. It's got protein. It's a good quick thing if a kid's having a meltdown.
And then?
And then you eat too many.
And then I got sick.
And then you got sick. All right. Well, we will move as close as we can to your eating a banana without you falling down or blacking out or, yes, vomiting, because that would also not be good. This is expensive audio equipment. I'd like to have it around for a while.
Yes.
All right. So
we'll try.
Can you pick up the banana? Just pick it up in your hand and tell me.
Do I have to?
Yes, you do. Okay, you picked it up, and you picked it up by just the tail end of it because you didn't even want to touch the fleshy yellow body.
Everything about this turns me off. Ugh. Okay, anyway, you do it.
Okay, I'll do it. Here, you give me the banana. Yeah. All right, I'm just going to do a little slit in the top, just like you might slit the neck of a rabbit before. Okay, and that's the banana being peeled open. I'm going to take a taste of banana. I haven't eaten a banana in a very long time. I don't much like bananas myself. And Maxime is turning away in disgust and covering his mouth. Would you take the banana now that it's peeled?
Do I have to?
Yes, just try. And why? Are you cutting off the part that I've chewed? Because you might get my germs?
No, absolutely not. I just want to eat the smallest piece of banana that I have to.
So you've taken a little slice of banana. And here it goes into his mouth. He smelled it, looking away, staring in agony.
There should be some video of it.
No. How's that going for you? Chewing.
Well, actually, it's perfectly ripe.
Yeah.
So it's not so bad because I probably add bananas that was way too ripe and the mushiness is not there.
Okay, so it's not mushy.
So it's not as bad as I was expecting it to be, but...
But you survived.
Yes, I did.
And now you have, as we talked about, one more experience in your life of tasting something that you thought you would always hate. It went down. It didn't come back up yet, anyway. Rock on, Maxime. You have been a wonderful test subject for this, our first segment of Stick This in Your Mouth. Thank you so much for participating.
You're welcome.
And we'll see you again next week. I'll probably see you again much sooner.
If no more bananas, please.
No more bananas. We'll move on to something simple like cheese. Well, listening to someone taste a banana might not have been the first thing you thought you'd be doing when you decided to tune into a food podcast today. You might not have expected to meet a philosopher of food who talks about plumbing, or a food entrepreneur who's also a philosopher. Remember, though, that we started out with the sounds of Jess Tseng's Ankung and the idea of complex relationships. Remember, too, that I said I'd explain how all these people are connected. Well, here goes. The Food and Music Performance Project that brought Jess and me together was organized by a sound artist named Sandeep Bhagwati. Sandeep is a composer and conductor living here in Montreal, and he's also our first respondent to the Making a Meal of It food questionnaire, which is coming up next. My part in Sandeep's project involved the use of a sourdough starter that I had received from the family of my dear friend Gigi Frassanito after he very sadly had died a number of years previously from stomach cancer. But Gigi and Taylor Kirkelis-Suarez and I were all at the University of Gastronomic Sciences together in 2005 and 2006, and that's where I first studied food and started reading the work of, yep, Lisa Heldke. Lisa later became a friend of mine after she was a reader of my PhD dissertation and a member of my oral defense committee. And perhaps strangest and most, just wonderful, was when Jess Tseng came out to Montreal from Brooklyn for the final performance of our food and music project with Sandeep, and she stopped off at her favorite craft brewery in New York State to buy me a gift to celebrate our collaboration, and it was, of course, the Suarez Family Brewery. But the amazing part of all this is that at the time, Jess had no idea that Taylor and I knew each other, and she certainly didn't know that Gigi and Taylor and I had done our masters together. So there you go. If that isn't a beautiful representation of complex food relationships, I don't know what is. Our final item on the Making a Meal of It menu is the podcast's Food Questionnaire, a gastronomic riff on the very well riffed upon Proust questionnaire. Going forward, each episode will feature the responses of an artist, a politician, a social change maker, or a scientist. A quick insight into the ways they eat and drink and think and feel. Think of it as a little digestif at the end of a hearty podcast meal. Sandeep Bhagwati is a professor in the Department of Music at Concordia University in Montreal. He's an award-winning composer and conductor, a theater director, and a media artist, and he describes himself as a nomad, an artist in sound, and a lover of poetry. Sandeep, what is your idea of a perfect food?
Food made by someone I like with care and with taste.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
When I must eat while background music plays.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
In divided by out equals one, meaning that their input and output, food and waste, are equal.
Which food person do you most admire?
Here I have a quote from Catull. Catulli Carmina. Ille mi par esse deo videtur, qui sedens adversus identitem te, spectat et audit, dulce crustulam, misero quod omnis eripit sensus mihi. Translation? To me, this person seems like a god who can face this sweet cake, sit and listen with equanimity while it takes all my breath away.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Bubble tea.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
Eros tea from Mariage Frère, which I order from Paris.
For what do you hunger?
I hunger for considerate, reasonable, constructive political discourses and actions everywhere.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
I don't know. Never. If I'm really hungry, why feign? I'm not hungry. I don't need to feign that.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
Concentration.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
Maillardability.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
Condiment of friendliness. It smooths the edges of life if ingested, but it can, if overused, riddle the liver with unspoken anger.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
Those that you come across in a desert.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
Patience.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
That the carbs of freshly baked bread could be neutralized by a huge dollop of butter.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would you like it to be?
I think cardamom. It's not essential, and it's too intense when you bite on it, but it's full of wonders when it's present.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
My red Victorinox kitchen knife.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Fresh pistachio marmoule.
What is your favorite aroma?
Orange water.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
Asafoetida.
Who are your favorite food writers?
Reading about food is like eating music to me.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
That depends on where I'm not. Those cuisines that evoke the most longing when I cannot access them. So it's fresh German bread or Swiss sweets in Canada, or Gujarati thalis and Mumbai street food almost everywhere outside of India. Somehow I never miss Canadian cuisine when I'm abroad.
What is your most powerful sense?
Hearing and smell.
What are your favorite agricultural, culinary, or gastronomic words?
Fallow, spice, and soupe.
What would you eat as your second to last meal?
Pani puri and dahi puri.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
If music be the food of love, he ate and listened avidly.
And what question would you add to this questionnaire, or would you like to ask me?
Which mountain did you have to bite your way through before you found your paradise? Or are you still chewing?
So that's it for this episode of Making a Meal of It. Thank you so much to my guests, Lisa Helke, Taylor Coquelis-Suarez, Maxime Giroux, and Sandeep Bhagwati, as well as Jess Tsang and her Anklung, and Gigi Frasenito and his sourdough starter. And a big shout out to Ben and Nick at Story Mode, who designed and produced the show's music and sounds. Go to storymode.ca for more. For news and updates about the podcast, check out makingamealofit.com or follow us at Making a Meal Podcast on most social media platforms. For news and updates about the podcast, check out makingamealofit.com or follow us at Making a Meal Podcast on most social media platforms. And of course, you know the drill all too well. Please subscribe, rate, and review us so that others can discover the show wherever you and they listen to podcasts. Next week's episode is all about what goes into selling food and beverages, or at least some of it, including the relationships and networks behind Montreal's Jean Talon public market, and an innovative model for blending design and wine with passion and conviviality. And it's sustainable, too. So join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, buen provecho, ita dakimasu, et bon appétit.